pick up a few extra dollars helping people prepare for hunts in Africa or Alaska, getting their rifles dialed in, teaching them how to dial and hold, that sort of thing. Well, after the tipping point of the UBL books, they came after everybody doing outside employment. They said we were teaching sniper tactics and giving away TTPs. Of course, that wasn't even close to what we were doing. I learned that the justice system is not always out to do what's right. They are out for the win. It was an eye-opener. Sounds like I should have added a few people to my list, Reese offered with a slight smile. Ha! I have a few names for you for next time. So what happened? They took a bunch of us to MAST. You wouldn't have believed it, Reese. Standing right next to the CO was the CMC who'd taught tactics and CQC out of Blackwater in North Carolina for years to make extra money on the weekends. Guess he just forgot. You didn't bring that up? Reese, you know me better than that. Not my style. Besides, he has to live with it, and if I remember correctly, his wife had more platoon hats than he did. Karma's a bitch sometimes. You actually already took care of one of them, Admiral Pilsner. Turns out he was even dirtier than we thought. His wife was funneling money from one of the SEAL-oriented foundations into an offshore account and selling influence through guided tours and access. Emails proved Pilsner knew all about it. If you hadn't killed him, he would have gone to jail for a long time. I think old Mrs. Pilsner got 6 years in the federal penitentiary. Probably be out in 4, I'd imagine. Looking out the window as the desert started to turn rocky and the redacted began to take shape in the distance, Reese swallowed and asked, "How's your son?" Freddie's son, Sam, had been born with a rare genetic disorder and would require full-time care for life. Reese remembered Freddie and his wife, Joan, putting on brave fronts as they dealt with the situation. Reese always had the highest respect for how they handled what had to be one of the toughest situations imaginable. Taking a breath, Freddie kept his eyes on the road. "He's okay, Reese. Thank you for asking. It's a lifelong journey. Our mission is to help him reach his full potential, regardless of what it is." "Was there ever a final diagnosis?" "Rafe didn't tell you?" "What do you mean?" Reese asked, puzzled. "He's the only reason we have a diagnosis." "He never mentioned it. But our relationship was a bit strained after Iraq when he left the teams, and..." Reese remembered. "The last time we met up, we were a little busy." "Yeah, well, we got the runaround from the Navy doctors for years. We almost went broke paying specialists from some private top-name hospitals for their opinion, hence the off-duty work at Bladelands. Nobody could figure it out. They kept trying to diagnose him with labels that just didn't fit. Joni knew. She knew they didn't have it right." "So, what happened?" Reese pressed. "Somebody mentioned it to Rafe. I always thought it was you." "We discussed it, but only in terms of you having a lot to deal with, especially with multiple deployments and workups, which, as we know, are stressful enough on a family without a special needs kid. You and Joni were an inspiration to everyone." "Thanks, man." "What happened between you and Rafe, anyway? You guys were like brothers." "Something happened in Iraq. Nothing you or I wouldn't have done in his shoes." "So how did Rafe help out?" Reese asked, clearly not wanting to discuss his old friend and getting the conversation back on track. "He talked with his father-in-law about it. Must have been right about the time he was getting out. Next thing we know, Joni is getting a call from the lead doctor at Southwestern Medical Center, just outside Dallas. Apparently Rafe's father-in-law donated most of the money to build it. Anyway, about a month later, we're getting picked up by a G550 private jet complete with a nurse and flown from Virginia Beach to Dallas. They assembled a team of genetic specialists from around the country, did a full workup of genetic tests on all of us, and sent our blood around the world to institutions doing similar research." "That's incredible." "Yeah. We would never have gotten a legitimate diagnosis from the Navy." What did they find out?
A researcher in the Netherlands had discovered a rare genetic mutation of the NR2F1 gene. It helps form the brain. They didn't even have a name for it back then, but now they call it Bosch-Boonstra-Schaff, after the team that discovered it. Sam was the 13th person ever diagnosed with it. There are more out there, they just don't know someone who can correctly diagnose it.
How is Joni doing? Reese asked.
She's a strong one, Reese. She dealt with it all while we were away doing the job, focused on the mission, on the team. She did it all alone. I'm not sure I could have done it in her position. Sam is a sweet kid. He's 9 now, but cognitively he's very young. He certainly keeps us on our toes.
How is he with the other kids?
Ha! He's sandwiched in between an older sister and younger brother that are absolute rock stars. We have to believe that Sam came to us for a reason, and that reason is that God thought we were strong enough to love him, while at the same time raising 2 other kids and giving them the attention and support they deserve.
You guys are an amazing family, Freddie. Sam is certainly lucky he got you to his parents.
Thanks, buddy.
Freddie nodded at the road ahead and changed subjects.
It will be a few miles off this main road back in those mountains. Not a bad place to spend a few months.
Chapter 34. Redacted Black Site, near Redacted, July. With the Redacted visible to the north and the rocky terrain flanking each side of the road, the Redacted looked like some of the Nevada training sites where Reese had learned to call in aircraft for bombing runs, known as close air support. Strain slowed the Hilux as they approached a stone-walled compound surrounded by open fields. He tapped the horn, and a few seconds later, the corrugated metal gate was pushed open by a muscular Westerner wearing hiking boots, desert tiger stripe pattern camouflage pants, and body armor over a brown t-shirt. Topped off with a thick reddish beard, Oakley sunglasses, and a battered ball cap, his appearance screamed private security contractor. His Glock sidearm was visible in a holster at his waist, and Reese was sure that a long gun was somewhere within arm's reach. The contractor returned Fred's wave as they rolled through the open gate.
Welcome to Falcon Base, Reese.
Reese took stock of the compound and saw a large 2-story stucco building at the center, surrounded by several single-story concrete structures of various sizes. Bringing the Hilux to a stop, Freddie said,
"That main house is home base. We'll bunk in there. It also has a mission planning space and classroom where you'll have your lessons."
Lessons?
Yeah. They've lined up an Islamic studies teacher to bring you up to speed on culture, language, all that. Make you stand out like less of an infidel when we get to work.
Interesting. How long am I supposed to be here?
Not sure, buddy. As long as it takes for our intel guys to get a solid location on Mo. My guess would be anywhere from 2 weeks to a month, but you know how this stuff works. We could get a call to go tomorrow, or it could be a few months.
Wonderful.
Over there is the arms room.
You sleep in there with your toys? Reese asked.
No, but it's not a bad idea.
The big barn-looking building is where we work out, keep our gear, all that kind of stuff. How's the gym?
Not bad. We've got a big rogue rig with ropes, bumper plates, kettlebells, a rower, versaclimber, assault bike, all that. We could start our own CrossFit box here. We have a couple of woodweight treadmills and some mats so we can roll. I'm sure you can still kick my ass in jiu-jitsu, but I've been training, so we'll see.
I'm pretty rusty, brother. You may have me.
I'm not buying that, Reese, not at all.
Ha! Guess we'll find out.
We have a range a couple clicks south of here, but I put some steel out back so we can shoot handguns without going anywhere.
Great. I haven't been shooting much, so I'll need the tune-up.
We'll get you dialed back in.
Freddie pulled the pickup in front of the main structure and
Both men climbed out. Reese grabbed his duffel from the bed of the Toyota and followed his agency handler toward the entrance. Freddy stopped abruptly at the door.
I almost forgot. Your name is James Donovan while we're here. We'll get you a full identity worked up, but that'll do for now.
Donovan, huh? As in Wild Bill?
I don't know.
The computer picks the names based on an algorithm that keeps your first name and doesn't repeat last names. It could be much worse, trust me. Some poor guy got John Holmes recently.
Reese just shook his head. As they entered, a slightly built man with dark features and a neatly cropped beard, wearing a clean white jellaba robe and red fez, greeted them politely in British-accented English.
Welcome, gentlemen. You must be Mr. Donovan. I am Majid Kifayat.
Assalamu alaikum, Majid.
Reese extended his hand.
Wa alaikum salam, Mr. Donovan. Please come in.
Reese bent down and untied his boots, leaving them outside the door in the Islamic tradition. Majid walked gracefully through the foyer of the large home, as if in deference to its grandeur. The Zellij mosaic tiles in bright blues and yellows, elaborate furnishings and arched doorways, represented classic, redacted architecture. Reese guessed that the home was hundreds of years old, or was at least designed to look that way. It was like a scaled-down version of the Alcazar Palace in Seville, Spain, which was built during the days when the redacted occupied much of the Iberian Peninsula.
Not like the plywood shitholes we lived in Afghanistan, is it? Freddy quipped.
I've stayed in worse.
Let me give you a quick tour and then we can get settled in.
Majid faded off to another part of the house as Freddy led the way through the foyer, which opened to a large living area adjacent to a stone and grass courtyard. A second-floor balcony overlooked the enclosure on all four sides. Freddy showed Reese the common areas of the home, the kitchen, bathrooms, and study that would serve as a classroom, before heading up a marble staircase.
Majid is cleared TSSCI, but even so, this is need to know, and he is not on that list. Upstairs is off-limits to the rest of the staff, so all our planning will happen up here.
Strain hit a succession of numbers on a cipher lock to open a series of rooms along the balcony hallway. One had been converted into a mini-briefing room with a large LCD screen on the wall, while two other adjoining rooms would be their sleeping quarters. They were small but clean and had been retrofitted with LG mini-split air conditioning units. The last room was secured with a heavy wrought iron gate, as well as a steel door that bolted shut from the inside.
This is the Alamo. If any Benghazi-style shit goes down, this is our fallback position.
What is the threat environment?
Redacted. A stable country, at least for this part of the world, and we have a good relationship with the
Redacted. That's their secret police.
We keep a very low profile here. We're also a good distance from town, and the cover story for this place is that it's used by the
Redacted
government to house visiting dignitaries. We built it under the guise of training host nation counter-terrorist units, which we'll end up doing, eventually.
Got it. How much security do we have?
We have four Redacted guys assigned. They're all solid, three Rangers and a Marine. All of them have multiple deployments. You and I can help in a pinch. We're a long way from reinforcements if something really goes sideways.
Thanks, Freddy. This place will work just fine.
Let's grab your stuff and get you squared away in your room. Then I'll show you my toys.
Freddy led Reese to the padlocked storage building that would serve as their small armory. Fluorescent lights hummed overhead in the long, narrow room where he had arranged various weapons on a stout wooden table. Reese recognized most of them, though a few were clearly more exotic than what he'd been issued in the teams. They were arranged from smallest to largest, starting with handguns and ending with belt-fed machine guns. Most of them had been spray-painted in mottled camouflage patterns. Okay, here you've got handguns. Even though you like the Glocks, I'd like you to try the new SIG 365, especially for work in low-vis environments. It holds more rounds than your .43.
I heard a lot about this during development. I'll give it a run, Reese said, immediately impressed by the subcompact pistol. While Reese loved his subcompact G43, the unprecedented 12+1 9mm capacity of the SIG 365, along with its surprisingly smooth striker fire trigger and night sights, made this one a winner right out of the box.
And this is the SIG P320 with upgraded triggers by Bruce Gray, Freddy said, picking up the SIG's new 9mm pistol. I think you'll like her.
I like her already, Reese said with a smile.
SIG had recently won the highly sought-after, nearly decade-long process to replace the Beretta 92F and supply the U.S. Armed Forces with a new advanced pistol, a variant of the SIG 320, now adopted as the M17-M18.
Is Mato still running training up at SIG? Reese asked, referring to their old SEAL Master Chief, who could probably still out-PT the newest Buds graduate.
He sure is. They have an incredible facility up there. He's crushing it.
Well, if we make it through the next few months and the tumor doesn't do me in, let's go pay him a visit.
Done deal, brother.
Freddy motioned toward a small, blocky, futuristic-looking submachine gun that looked like something out of a science fiction movie. A curved magazine protruded out of the weapon's pistol grip, and a smaller foregrip folded down from near the muzzle. A tubular suppressor extended its length, and the entire package was dappled with a brown and tan homemade camouflage scheme.
Next, we've got some MP7s, like we use a dam neck. You ever shot one?
I got to play around with one when I augmented you guys a few years back, but I didn't spend enough time on it to get proficient. We don't get that high-speed stuff on the West Coast.
Roger. Pretty slick little gun. Compact and has a really high rate of fire. Great for close-in stuff that needs to be done quietly. When you use the subsonic ammo, you can hardly hear it. Easy to shoot with this aimpoint micro red dot. Just be aware that its terminal performance isn't what you're used to due to the little 4.6 cartridge.
In English, Freddy, English.
Strain exhaled and feigned an eye roll. It uses a really little bullet, so if you shoot a guy with it, put half a mag into him.
That I understand.
Next, for rifles, we've got HK416s that we'll use instead of the M4, both 10-inch and 14-inch models. It works just like an M4, but it's a lot less ammo-sensitive and more reliable due to the piston system, especially when it gets dirty. We can mount whatever optic you want.
Reese could sense his new partner's excitement as he described the various weapons and their features.
Now I see why you really went over to the dark side.
Freddy smiled.
Dude, this is the coolest part of my job. I can pick any guns I want and trick them out to my heart's content. Kid in a candy store, bro.
You're like a whiskey tango version of Q from James Bond, Reese joked.
Strain broke into his best English accent. 007, here are your sniper options, a La Rue OBR in 5.56 and a gun that I built myself in 260,
dropping the accent and continuing the description like a proud father.
It's got a carbon fiber barrel from Proof, so it keeps cool and it's light. You'll notice that I've put the same flash hiders on just about everything so we can mount the same suppressors across the board. The 30 cal cans work just fine on the 5.56 and the 260.
Is the 260 like a 308?
Fills the same role, but it's better in nearly every regard. It shoots faster, flatter, and with less recoil. Same mags as a 7.62, but has the dope of a 300. I've been trying to sell everyone on this round for years, but the military is slow to move on anything.
I'll take your word for it.
How did you ever make it through sniper school? Freddy asked in feigned astonishment.
I must have had a good spotter, Reese smiled back. Must have, Freddy agreed. Anyway, I doubt we'll do anything super long range, but we have an Accuracy International in 300 Norma, and even a Barrett M10750 if we need it. We've got some belt feds as well as a bunch of anti-armor stuff. Plus, we have demo. He pointed to a row of tubes leaning against the back wall of the room. Law rockets, AT-4s, even a javelin in that case back there. Those things are like a quarter mil a pop, but certainly do the job. Well, I'll be sure to use those sparingly. Reese noticed a row of Ops Corps ballistic helmets fitted with L3 Technologies, GPNVG-18 night observation devices hanging on the wall, the best NODs that money could buy. The devices were easily recognizable thanks to the four panoramic lenses that gave the user better peripheral vision than with other models. Four bangers, huh? That's rich kid shit. Taxpayer money spends easy, man. Those things are so much better than the stuff we used to use.
You're kind of a gear snob, Freddy.
I like nice stuff, man. What can I say?
Chapter 35. It was a 20-minute ride in the Hilux to the range, the wide-open landscape reminding Reese of being back at sea. The mostly flat, sometimes rolling, but always barren terrain made for a perfect training area. A local construction firm had used a bulldozer to create impact berms at various distances. There was a U-shaped berm 100 meters deep for short-range work, and beyond it was a rifle range for shots as far as 1,800 meters. A faded red shipping container served as a supply closet, and its roof gave them line of sight to the sniper targets. There were steel plate targets of various sizes and shapes scattered across the landscape, allowing for shots at just about every conceivable distance. What looked to be an inoperable Mercedes sedan from the 1970s sat inside the perimeter.
"Let me guess, that's my ride?" Reese quipped.
"Yeah, man, sorry about the windshield. We'll have to get you some goggles."
As they parked, Freddy's usually casual tone and body language shifted to all business.
"Okay, we'll start with some handgun work, then get you going on the MP7 before moving to the 416s. We can mess with the long-range stuff another day."
"Sounds good, buddy."
Freddy unlocked the shipping container and swung open the heavy steel doors. Inside were cases of spray paint, assorted cardboard targets, additional steel plates, several cases of ammunition, and pieces of plywood cut into various shapes.
"Help me with this barricade." Freddy motioned to a vertical plywood facade, with steps down one side and filled with holes of varying shapes and sizes.
They carried the mock barricade to the center of the range and set it up next to the Mercedes.
"Go ahead and get the kinks out with your 9mm while I get some of this other stuff set up. There's ammo in the back of the truck."
Reese nodded and walked toward a row of three steel silhouette targets. It occurred to him that the last time he'd fired a handgun, it had been into the mouth of a federal agent responsible for killing his family. It was difficult for his mind to reconcile that act with the fact that he was back in the employ of the United States government.
Crazy world.
Reese was wearing the SIG 320 in a holster on his belt rather than his usual Black Point tactical mini wing concealment rig. There was no reason to try to conceal a handgun while wearing full battle gear. Skills such as shooting are highly perishable, and Reese hadn't done any serious firearms training in close to a year. Being an expert in anything means doing the basics exceptionally well. So Reese started with the fundamentals. Putting on his ear protection, he took a deep breath to focus. Then, standing 10 yards from a steel plate, Reese drew the handgun from his holster, his left hand meeting the gun at his pectoral muscle as the muzzle rotated toward the target. He pushed the SIG out with both hands, gripping firmly until his elbows nearly locked, pressing the trigger as he drove the gun swiftly toward the target. His eyes met the front sight just as the trigger broke, and his brain recognized the instant gratification of a center mass hit on the steel target as the gun recoiled slightly upward. Keeping his trigger finger on the trigger, he scanned to the left and right of his target before moving his finger to the frame to look behind him for threats, before replacing the handgun in his holster. Situational awareness. He drew again, a bit faster this time, and put two rounds into the target in quick succession. He repeated the process until the magazine ran dry, performed a slide-lock reload, stepping to his left, and fired two more rounds. He moved farther from the targets and began engaging multiple plates in rapid succession, quickly transitioning from one to the next. Speed came back quickly, thanks to hundreds of thousands of rounds fired over the past 18 years during similar training sessions. He had burned his way through 10 magazines when he saw Freddy watching him over his left shoulder during one of his post-target scans.
"Just like riding a bike, looking sharp, Reese."
"Thanks. Feels good to be back at it."
"I bet. Let me paint these targets and we'll get dialed in on the fun gun."
Freddy shook a rattle can of spray paint as he approached the targets that were covered with the gray splatters of Reese's pistol rounds. He recoated them with glossy white paint and waved for Reese to follow him to a folding table with the suppressed MP7 and a row of loaded magazines. Freddy picked up the tan and brown camouflaged submachine gun and pointed the muzzle skyward.
"Okay, Reese, this will be a new toy for you. This thing shoots really fast and has almost no recoil. It's also exceptionally quiet with serious penetration, so if the bad guys are wearing armor, it's a better choice than a handgun. We started using them at Damn Neck, and a lot of guys fell in love with them."
Freddy retracted the small stock to its rear position and folded down a stubby grip below the barrel.
"You can shoot it like a handgun in a pinch, but you won't hit much. The mags go in the grip like an Uzi and hold 40 rounds. You cock it here, and the selector is here,"
he demonstrated, handing the firearm to Reese.
"It might look like it works like the old MP5, but that's just because it's an HK. It'll operate like an M4 from your perspective. Have at it. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast."
"I've heard that somewhere before," Reese said, remembering the old SEAL adage. Reese loaded a magazine into the hollow grip and moved the safety selector to semi-auto. His eye quickly found the crisp red dot of the aimpoint microsight, and he pressed the trigger. The shot was totally underwhelming, with almost no discernible recoil and minimal report, reminding him of the pellet rifle his grandfather had given him as a kid. A single tiny speck of gray was visible at the center of the target 30 meters away. He flipped the selector to full auto and leaned a bit harder into the gun to control its rise. Reese tried for a short burst, and 5 or 6 suppressed rounds spat from the muzzle, pinging against the steel target downrange. The gun barely moved. He fired a longer burst, 10 or so rounds, and was amazed by how controllable the little gun was. He emptied the remainder of the magazine into the target in a longish string, and all 24 rounds stayed in the 8-inch circle. He turned to his friend, grinning ear to ear.
"I like it. I knew you would. It has its limitations, but it's definitely useful."
Reese spent a few minutes familiarizing himself with his new toy before Freddy began running him through some basic drills with it. He held an electronic shot timer that would measure Reese's reaction time from the buzzer to his first round on target. Freddy set up orange traffic cones on the range and had Reese navigate them in various ways as he engaged the targets, shooting while moving forward, backward, and laterally, and ultimately shooting while weaving through the cones like a sports car on a slalom course. Gunfights aren't static events, and perfecting the skill of shooting while moving could mean the difference between life and death. They fired from various positions over, under, and through the plywood barricade, and practiced using the junk Mercedes for cover. After hours of work with the handgun, MP7, and HK416 carbines, it was time for a breather. They broke for lunch and talked as they ate gyro-like sandwiches on the tailgate of the Hilux. Reese opened the paper wrapper and looked at the contents as if the food was booby-trapped.
"They put mayo on these things?" he asked in disgust. "You and your mayo. I'd forgotten about that phobia. Wonder if there's a scientific name for it."
"It's so nasty."
"Fear not, Reese. No mayo.
It's some kind of yogurt sauce.
Visibly relieved, Reese took a tentative bite. His face lit up in approval.
You always were a natural, Reese. It kills me that I eat and sleep this stuff and you just stroll out here and shoot like a champ.
Reese shrugged as he chewed a bite full of lamb and pita.
Should I sandbag a little to make you feel better?
Ha! No, dude. Keep it up. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we can get back to our families.
Freddy paused for a second, catching himself.
Sorry, bro. Didn't mean it like that.
I forgot. It's okay.
Seriously, stop apologizing. You're a dear friend and a great dad. No need to apologize.
I'm just sorry, man. With all of the challenges we have with Sam, at least I can hug him when I get home.
I admire the hell out of you and Joni. You guys never complain, never ask for anything. You just get it done.
You play the cards you're dealt, Reese. That's all you can do. When you look at the statistics of families dealing with special needs kids, the odds are that the added stress breaks you apart. For some reason, it made us a closer, more compassionate family. It made us a team.
Never look at the odds, buddy. My hat is off to you guys.
Now, let's go train so you can get home to see them. After lunch, both men strapped on their heavy chest rigs, harnesses of nylon webbing laden with body armor, gear, and loaded magazines. They spent the afternoon working as a team, perfecting the choreography of shooting, moving, and communicating. They began at a walking pace and progressed rapidly to full speed. If one of them was moving or reloading, the other was putting rounds on the target. By day's end, they were doing it seamlessly and without words. When the sun went below the horizon, they attached NODs to their helmets and repeated the drills in darkness, their infrared lasers painting the targets invisible to the naked eye. The only sounds came from the hard ground crunching beneath their boots and the suppressed gunshots from their muzzles. To the two professional commandos, who had spent more than half of their lives working at night, both in training and on combat deployments, their actions were as natural as breathing.
Chapter 36. Iraq-Syria Border. August. Lieutenant Colonel Saeed had received the encrypted message on his phone the previous evening and had spent the day planning and coordinating. He'd picked 15 of his best men and called it in as a training mission. An Mi-8 from their air wing, flown by Iraqi pilots trained to fly with NODs over the pine forests of the Florida Panhandle, courtesy of the CIA, took off under the cover of darkness and flew them to this rendezvous site. As the men waited in the darkness, they smoked and checked weapons and gear, joking with one another, just like every group of soldiers in history. Saeed loved his men and observed them with both pride and sadness. To many, it would seem odd for an Iraqi special operations commander to be handing his troops over to work under a former general in the Syrian army, but to Saeed, nothing was strange anymore. Times were simpler under Saddam, when ruthless loyalty to the Ba'ath Party and its leaders was all that it took to thrive. Following the 2003 invasion, Saeed had worked for the Americans and then the inept and corrupt government they'd left behind in their hasty departure. He'd fought ISIS as they swept across much of the only country he'd ever called home, and watched with even more confusion as they were beaten back by the Iranian-influenced Shia militias and the Kurds, who were still allied with the Americans. Would he work for the Turks next? The Iranians? Who knew? He would serve nearly any master so long as they were in power. That's how you lived in a place like Iraq. It had always been all about survival for him and his family. Side jobs, such as this one that had brought him to the middle of the desert, would help ensure that he had the resources to someday move his family to a safer place. One of his men spotted the trucks driving in complete darkness across the flat desert terrain. This was his cue to leave. He hugged each one and bid them farewell, hopeful that he would see them again.
Captain Daraji,
Saeed said, motioning to the officer in charge.
Yes, Colonel. You will be picking up two local assets when you land. Their handler will be briefing them up. For them, it is about the cause. For us, it is about payment.
Understood, Colonel, Daraji said, snapping a smart salute.
Ma'al salama.
Fi aman Allah, Saeed responded, returning his subordinate's salute. As Saeed boarded the now empty cargo bay of the helicopter, he asked his creator to watch over them. He didn't need to wait around to see what would happen next. His men would board the trucks and be driven into Syria to a military airfield under Assad's control, where they and their gear would be transferred to an AN-26 cargo aircraft. This twin-engine workhorse was built in the former Soviet Union and could serve as everything from a flying hospital to a bomber. It lacked the range to reach their destination on a single tank of fuel, so they would fly over the Mediterranean Sea until they refueled at a remote airstrip in the failed state of Libya. From then, God willing, it was on to the target.
Chapter 37. Redacted. Black Site. Near. Redacted. August. Rhys knew he was almost out of air. Despite his attempts to stay calm, his heart raced, eating up precious oxygen. His world had darkened at the edges of his vision due to the suffocation. He was in trouble, and he knew it. He was suddenly with his father, hiking a steep, muddy trail canopied by the thick vegetation of North Carolina's Nantahala National Forest. His father's career in what they thought was the Foreign Service meant long periods of separation, so Rhys cherished the time they spent together. They'd walked down a twisting narrow path to a surging waterfall, hidden miles from the nearest highway. The steady rains in these mountains provided a constant source of creek water that had worn the rocky face so smooth that you could actually slide down part of the falls in the seated position and splash into the deep pool at the bottom. It was a place where people had gathered long before any Europeans had stepped ashore in the New World, and it was still special. The heavens opened, and within seconds they were drenched from an abrupt deluge of rain. Their respite from the summer heat had become a shivering battle for warmth. His father took a look at his son, whose face was a mask of misery, and decided that they would hike back to the Wagoneer at the trailhead, which meant a steep and muddy climb in the torrential downpour. James's little legs powered along as best they could, attempting to match his father's long and powerful stride.
"Come on, Jamesy, you can do it, buddy. Just put one foot in front of the other."
James wasn't about to let his father or himself down. He'd climb three steps forward and slide two steps back in the slick brown ooze that the trail had become, but kept moving forward, his legs feeling like jelly. Thomas Rhys wiped the crystal of the faded steel dive watch on his wrist.
20 more minutes and we're back at the car, James. Just don't quit, buddy. Life is hard sometimes, but if you stay with it and keep moving forward, you'll prevail. Trust me.
Rhys kept hiking, maintaining a stiff upper lip and a stride that mimicked his father's gait. He tripped over twisted roots on the trail, his muddy sneakers squished brown water with each step, but he pressed on.
"You've got it, son. Never quit."
He wasn't going to quit. Rhys was suddenly back in the present, sweat stinging his eyes. He struggled to free himself, but the hold was too strong, the other man's legs locking his neck in a delta of flesh and muscle and restricting the flow of blood and oxygen to his brain. His opponent was on his back with one hand pulling Reese's right arm across his body and the other pulling downward on his head. The man's right thigh was pressed against one side of his neck and a bent leg hooked over the back of his head, compressing Reese's own shoulder into his throat. In jiu-jitsu terms, the man had Rhys in what was known as a triangle choke. He had set the trap perfectly, and Rhys had taken the bait.
"Damn, this guy is strong!"
Rhys sucked oxygen and for a moment gained absolute clarity regarding his position. The proper technique for escape from a triangle had been drilled into him years before by sixth-degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt master Renzo Gracie,
at his academy in New York. Though they trained constantly in Virginia Beach, Reese and his platoon still made the six-hour pilgrimage to Manhattan to train with the grandson of legendary Gracie Jiu-Jitsu founder Carlos Gracie as often as they could. With a surge of energy, Reese postured up, craning his neck upward in the process. The man saw his attempt to escape and increase the force upon Reese's neck. Using all his strength, he moved his hips as high as possible and began to move laterally, slowly turning his body at a right angle to that of his adversary. Like a coiled spring, Reese snapped his hip against the man's legs, breaking the choke. His lungs filled with air that, despite the heat and odor of sweat, was like a taste of paradise. Continuing his momentum, Reese worked quickly into side control, snaking one arm under the man's neck and one over his body, locking his hands into a gable grip. It was a chance to suck in critical oxygen, clear his mind, and regain his composure after nearly blacking out only seconds earlier. Taking the initiative, brought by his position, Reese threw his leg over the man's body and climbed astride, putting him into mount, the most dominant position in ground fighting. He grasped the man's arm and pushed it to the ground, causing his rival to turn onto his side in defense against the shoulder lock. As he did so, Reese slid farther up his torso and took his adversary's exposed back. His opponent knew what Reese was trying to do and fought a grip fight to prevent Reese from getting his arm across his exposed throat. Reese used his legs like hooks, sliding them around the front of the man's body like a constricting snake. His arm slid past his opponent's sweat-soaked hand and wrapped over the neck. With his opposite hand, he locked it into the crook of his elbow, using it as a fulcrum against the throat and carotid artery. With a technically perfect rear-naked choke, there is essentially no escape. The other fighter had 3 to 5 seconds before he would black out. Reese felt the tap on his forearm and released his grip. Freddie Strain gasped for air.
"Shit! I thought I had you with that triangle."
"You almost did," Reese admitted, sucking in precious oxygen.
"Thanks for not making eye contact."
Both men laughed at the tired jiu-jitsu joke. Reese lay back onto the mats and took some deep breaths.
"I'm proud of you, James. You didn't quit."
His father tousled his son's wet hair in the front seat of his faux-paneled Jeep back at the trailhead.
"Remember, a fight isn't just about surviving, it's about prevailing. There's a difference."
These weeks of training in Redacted had hardened his resolve and cleared his mind. Reese had become a warrior again. After their rolling session, Reese and Freddy ran a few laps around the inside wall of the compound before getting into their morning workout. Like most of the special operations community, their physical training centered on useful strength, cardiovascular endurance, and durability, which, as both of them were pushing age 40, was increasingly important. Looking like a steroid-fueled bodybuilder was not part of the equation and was a liability in terms of both physical performance and blending into civilian populations. Their workouts pulled elements from various coaches and training programs, including CrossFit, Jim Jones, and Strong First. The idea wasn't to be able to compete with endurance athletes, powerlifters, or alpinists, but to achieve a broad-based level of fitness that would allow them to perform well in each of those areas. After a series of warm-up exercises that most would consider a serious workout, they completed the Strength and Endurance Hero Wad Murph, named in honor of Navy SEAL Lieutenant Mike Murphy. Wearing their body armor, they started with 100 burpees, followed by 4 100-yard buddy carries. Then it was right into a 2-mile run, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 air squats, followed by another 2-mile run. Both men powered through, thinking of the scores of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who didn't make it home. After a shower and lunch, it was off to school for Reese while Freddy caught up on whatever admin tasks Langley was sending his way. By dusk, they'd be back on the range, which tonight meant long-distance precision shooting in low light. The rhythm of the training suited Reese well,
and reminded him of his days as a young enlisted SEAL in the pre-9/11 era, the lifestyle that led many to joke that the SEAL acronyms stood for Sleep, Eat, Lift, or as their Army brothers used to joke, Sleep, Eat, and Lie Around. It felt good to be training alongside his old sniper buddy, honing his skills for the mission ahead.
"A file came in on Mo from Langley," Freddy said as they packed up their rifles under a beautiful starlit sky. "Makes for some interesting reading. I printed it and left it in the briefing room safe. Give it a look tonight. Might help shed some light on where he is and why he's turned."
Reese nodded. If his old friend really had switched sides after their time in Iraq and was now running a terrorist cell in Europe, Reese was going to have to be at the top of his game. Later that night, Reese turned on a small lamp at his desk, opened the CIA file on Mohammed Farouk, and began to read. Mo's father had been an academic, educated first at the University of Baghdad, majoring in biology, and then studying abroad, where he completed his PhD in plant toxins from the University of East Anglia's School of Biological Sciences in Norwich, England. Returning to Iraq, he had found a home teaching and conducting research at his alma mater, eventually rising to chair the biological sciences department. Both of Mo's older sisters were studying at the university where their father taught and would sometimes stop by to visit him between classes. Mo had been blessed with his father's intellect and his mother's good looks, excelling in school and on the football pitch. He chased girls with his friends and ran a small black market enterprise selling bootlegged CDs of American and European pop music that put some additional Iraqi dinar in his pocket. Biology and plant toxins didn't mean much to Mohammed. From his perspective, they were just something his dad lectured about in what seemed to be a fairly dull profession. Life was good for the popular young Iraqi, until his sisters did not return from university. Pretending to be asleep that night, Mohammed strained to listen to his parents' hushed voices as they sat hunched around the small round dining table where they had all eaten together for as long as he could remember. From beneath the covers of his mat on the floor of the next room, Mo had risked a glance into the kitchen. The fear he saw etched across the faces of his mother and father would be forever imprinted on his memory. He distinctly heard his mother's strained voice whisper, "Uday." It was just beginning to dawn on the young man that his sisters might never join them for dinner again. His father had been a kind and thoughtful man, insisting on speaking and reading English and German in their house so that his children could live fuller, more prosperous lives. When he said goodbye to his only son the next morning, he did so in Arabic. That night, Mohammed and his mother waited up for a man who would never return. In the days of Saddam, one did not ask questions, particularly when those questions involved one of the president's sons. Inquiries at the university went unanswered. Mo and his mother attempted to meet with school officials, only to be kept waiting indefinitely in the reception area. Dr. Farouk's name had been removed from his office door and the entire room was empty, except for a desk and chair. It was as if he had never existed. Both mother and son knew better than to go to the authorities. 6 months later, his mother passed away in her sleep, and 16-year-old Mohammed was alone. But Mohammed had a plan. He had learned patience from his parents and knew enough to realize that he needed training, intelligence, and access if he was to avenge them. Even in a police state, there were ways to go unnoticed. As in most countries around the world, there was a subset of the population in Iraq's capital city that went almost ignored among its 8 million inhabitants. The homeless were invisible, and Mohammed became one of them, joining the ranks of the unwanted, sleeping in the streets, learning to subsist from the alcoholics, drug abusers, criminals, and the mentally ill. Out of necessity, he learned to fight, to defend what was his, but more important,
he learned how to think like a criminal, like a survivor. The logic he had learned from his father was applied practically in the back alleys of the ancient city. Under the constant threat of government sweeps and forced disappearances, Mohammed's black market CD money provided just enough cash for meals, which he shared with those who passed along their knowledge. When the kid, known simply as Mo, vanished, the rhythm of the dusty streets continued unabated. But Mohammed wasn't imprisoned by the secret police, nor was his body bloating in the Tigris. He was on his way north. North to those who lived in the mountains along the Turkish border. North to be either killed or accepted by the Kurdish Peshmerga, the military wing of Iraq's largest ethnic minority group. The Kurdish people had known nothing but war for centuries. Rebellion was in their blood. Blurring the lines between a guerrilla force and standing army, Peshmerga translates as those who face death. And Mohammed was ready to do just that. Exhausted and near death himself on arrival, he was at first a curiosity until his value was recognized by senior Peshmerga leaders. They decided he could be useful. Training began in earnest, and the boy from Baghdad started his formal education in irregular warfare. When the CIA reactivated their network in northern Iraq before the 2003 invasion, they were surprised to find a young Iraqi fluent in English, German, Arabic, and Kurdish. Not yet in his mid-20s, Mohammed had trained and fought alongside his adopted Kurdish brothers and sisters, distinguishing himself in battle, and had been hardened by the atrocities of the Iraqi government. That government was not merely quelling an uprising, it was systematically conducting a campaign of genocide against the Kurdish people. From the CIA's perspective, Mohammed Farouk had all the qualities and attributes required of a deep penetration agent in what would be the new Iraqi government. Unbeknownst to them at the time, Mohammed had another, more personal agenda. As part of the CIA support of Peshmerga forces, Mohammed was released into the custody of his new masters. At a base in Jordan, he began a training program with U.S. Army Special Forces, building on his experience in northern Iraq. The agency had assembled a group of Iraqi exiles and selected Kurds for special operations training by two Army ODAs for what the trainees were told were leadership positions in the post-invasion Iraqi army. As with most undertakings in the intelligence world, that was true only on the surface. At its heart, it was a selection process. Aptitude with firearms and explosives were tested, along with close-quarters combat and decision-making under the stressors of urban combat simulations. The agency's best polygraphers and psychologists were flown in from Northern Virginia to administer their exams, both to assess loyalties and establish a baseline for future scrutiny. Those who excelled eventually boarded a C-17 that touched down 16 hours later at Hurlburt Field, Florida. From there, they were driven in windowless vans to a classified CIA facility for indoctrination, further assessment, and doctorates in the darker arts of espionage under the expert tutelage of the agency's Special Activities Division. The small group that graduated became known as the Scorpions, and in early 2003, they returned to Jordan where they staged for war. Led by the CIA's ground branch, the Scorpions infiltrated Iraq prior to the official invasion to coordinate precision airstrikes, incite rebellion to overthrow the regime, and assassinate high-ranking members of the Iraqi government. Of the 52 high-value targets on his issued deck of cards, Mohammed kept only one in his pocket, the Ace of Hearts, Uday Hussein. A knock on the door pulled Reese out of the past. "Yeah?" he called out, flipping the page. The door opened, and Freddy leaned against the door jamb, a bottle of water in his hand. "Water?" "Sure," Reese replied, turning in his chair to catch the toss from his friend. "I told you it was interesting reading. Did you know all that?" "Mo told me some of it, but not in the detail here. This thing reads like a novel." "Well, as you can see, the agency invested a lot of time, energy, and effort, not to mention money, on him. The psychologists and analysts did a thorough job. Want to see your file? Freddy asked with a smile.
Ha, not tonight. The psychoanalysis might be a bit much.
Good call.
What I can't figure out is why he would switch sides. He seems like the perfect spook. The background and right motivators are there. I just don't see how or why he goes rogue.
Obviously, the big brains at Langley couldn't figure it out either. Get some rest, buddy, and let me know if that file sparks any ideas.
Sleep did not come easily. Reese's thoughts kept returning to a young orphan living in the treacherous streets of Baghdad, dreaming of revenge.
Chapter 38.
Mr. Donovan, I fear if I do not know the nature of your mission, I will not be able to assist as readily as I might.
Sorry, Majid. I think the initial idea was to get me trained up enough to pass off as a disgruntled veteran who converted to Islam, but Freddy mentioned that now I might go in as an aspiring novelist doing research, so I'm not really sure. I did my best to study the enemy while in the military, but I fear I fell short. I don't mean that all Muslims are the enemy. It just came out that way.
Majid smiled, his wise professor's eyes betraying the fact that he genuinely liked his new pupil.
Mr. Donovan, Majid, how many times do I have to tell you that it's okay to call me James?
Ah, yes. James. Part of this training is also to familiarize you with your new last name. Mr. Donovan, it is.
Reese smiled. They'd had this conversation before. He'd come to thoroughly enjoy his time spent with Majid and never tired of hearing him speak. Majid had been put through the ringer by his native country of Great Britain and a foreign one, Egypt. After what Reese had suffered from elements of his own government, he felt a certain kinship with Majid. If Majid could forgive, maybe Reese could too.
As I was saying, Mr. Donovan, if you could tell me the country in which you were going to attempt this foolish stunt, I could be of more use.
I honestly don't know exactly where I'm going. I need to make contact with an old friend through the Muslim community somewhere in Europe, I think.
Reese smiled at the man he now considered a friend.
Majid, I wish we'd had you around a few years back. Maybe we wouldn't be in this mess of a global insurgency.
Unfortunately, I was on the other side then, Mr. Donovan, as you well know.
They had discussed this many times, but Reese kept coming back to it. How someone who had been through what Majid had experienced could be so positive and energetic was inspiring beyond words.
I guess we are all on our own path, huh?
I can certainly affirm that, Mr. Donovan. It took more years than I care to remember, but I am at that stage in life where I have taken accountability for my past actions. My only desire is to pass along my experience so that others can make more informed decisions that influence the narrative and counter-narrative by extremists on both sides. Though you know I dislike characterizing things in such polarizing terms. It's not as easy as a clash of civilizations. It's more nuanced than that, as we've discussed before. This is not about destroying infrastructure or assassinating various so-called leaders. This is a war of ideology, and it won't be won or lost on the battlefield.
Agreed, Reese said, shaking his head. We can hit them every night where they sleep, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, wherever they seek refuge, and still not defeat the idea that is militant Islam.
Have I ever told you what Dr. Muhammad Badi told me when we were imprisoned together in Masra Tora prison?
Majid asked his student, referring to Cairo's infamous prison where he had spent considerable time.
He said, "Ideas are bulletproof."
Yeah, I've heard something similar before. I think it was, "You can't kill an ideology." Kind of reminds me of our response to that same ideology with a war on terror. We declared war on a tactic,
while what we are really doing is countering an idea. Politicians thought we could kill our way out of it. Maybe they thought we'd kill our way to their next election victory.
Perhaps, Mr. Donovan, perhaps, but I urge you not to be too hard on them. To borrow and paraphrase from your Bible, they know not what they do.
I understand, but we trusted our leaders, both elected and uniformed, to study and understand the conflict. We had let things fester for so long that any other response wasn't even on the radar. It was war.
Yes, and that is why, after all these years, I wish to share my journey with those who can make a difference for future generations. My son in London will be on his way to college soon. I missed most of his life, and he's never forgiven me. I let my hate of the West guide my every move. From the fights with skinheads in Essex to my recruitment by Hizb al-Tahrir, I bought into the us-versus-them narrative and truly believed that a global caliphate would right the wrongs I felt from the bullying and beatings by the white fascists who roamed Essex looking for smaller groups of packies to torment and harass. Today I feel sorry for them, but more important, I understand them. They fell for the same narrative, albeit the other side, but the same narrative nonetheless.
How did prison not turn you into a more hardened jihadi like we always hear about on the news?
I'm not saying that never happens, Mr. Donovan. I'm saying that it didn't happen in my case, and strangely enough, had I not been imprisoned in Egypt in the same cell block as Dr. Badi, I might either still be in there, or I might be planning the next 9/11.
Well, I guess I'm glad, Reese said with a semi-confused look on his face.
Ha! As strange as it sounds to say, I would not change a thing. It was just happenstance that I ended up in Masrat Torah. I picked the wrong day to fly to Egypt to start my graduate-level Islamic studies program. July 7th, 2005. Of course, I knew nothing of the attacks, though at the time I was so consumed by hate that I would have gladly assisted. As fate and Allah would have it, I was known to authorities for my outspoken criticism of the British government for its treatment of the Muslim community, unlike the bombers that day who were clean, as they say in intelligence circles.
That July day was one Reese knew well. Four Al-Qaeda operatives wearing S-vests killed 52 people and wounded more than 700 in coordinated bombings across London. It was the first suicide bombing to target Great Britain and their deadliest terrorist attack up to that point, since Pan Am Flight 103 was brought down over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. Departing on a flight to Egypt hours prior to the attack put me on the MI5 and MI6 radar. When I landed in Cairo, I was immediately arrested by the state security apparatus, Aman al-Dawla. I was handcuffed, blindfolded, stripped naked, and thrown into a van with a few other unfortunate souls, whose only crime that day was flying to Egypt.
Reese was enthralled. In the SEAL teams, the old and often quoted Sun Tzu saying, "Know thy enemy," was usually followed by a class on Islam, thereby grouping enemy and Islam together for a platoon or troop of young, hard-charging frogmen who would rather be out training than stuck in a classroom, listening to a lecture from the intel shop by someone who had probably looked up most of the brief on Wikipedia. He had made so many Muslim friends in his travels over the years, he always found it hard to listen to the intelligence briefings focused on Islam.
"Do you know the difference between Islam and Islamism, Mr. Donovan?"
"I thought Islamism is the same as Islamic fundamentalism."
"Not precisely.
I know we've discussed the basics over the past weeks, like the difference between Sunni and Shia, the various calls to prayer, and the five pillars of Islam. It is important to understand this next point, Mr. Donovan, and it took me 7 years in an Egyptian prison to grasp it. Islam is a religion, just as Christianity is a religion. Islamism
is the idea that a certain interpretation, any interpretation of Islam, must be imposed on society at large. It's a political movement, a totalitarian movement, with Islam as its vehicle, with the goal of eventually creating the Khilafah. Submit to Islam and join the movement or be put to the sword. The minority has hijacked the narrative and is gaining momentum and followers. I was one of those followers, Mr. Donovan. I recruited impressionable young men just like me to the movement. I hijacked their lives. This is how I atone. I share my story with the younger minds coming up through the ranks at MI5 and MI6, and have been fortunate enough to do the same at your CIA, FBI, and occasionally the Department of State. And it was Dr. Badi that changed your outlook and understanding of your religion. Not of my religion, Mr. Donovan, but of the movement. Though he is very old now and has accepted that he will die in his prison cell, Dr. Badi is the current leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was he who smuggled Sayyid Qutb's Islamist manifesto out of Mazra Torah in the early 60s. It is ironic that that very text ignited an already simmering movement of militant Islamism and inspired Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri to form Al-Qaeda. So how did you get out? How did anyone even find out where you were? Reese asked, fascinated by the story. Majid looked at his watch. That, Mr. Donovan, is a tale for another day, he said with a twinkle in his eye. I fear we have gone too late as it is, and it is almost time for evening prayer. Thank you, Majid. I'd like to meet your son one day. Majid paused. Yes, I'd like to meet him again, too, he said, his voice trailing off with more than a tinge of sadness. And, Mr. Donovan, I sense our time here is coming to a close. Remember, the United States is the most powerful nation on earth, just as Great Britain was before her. Rome and the Mongols held that title as well, but more formidable than the dominance of those empires has always been the power of an idea. As those great powers rose and fell, ideas remained. Never forget that, Mr. Donovan. And now it is time for prayer.
Chapter 39. Reese was awake, staring up into the darkness when he heard the dog barking in the distance. You might have the best plan, the most high-tech equipment, and the best trained operators, but the dogs could always give you away. He wasn't wearing his watch, but he figured it was about 4 a.m. Sleep hadn't come easy since the death of his family and SEAL brothers. He'd spent many an hour listening to the rolling seas, the sounds of the African bush, and herein redacted, the hum of his room's AC unit. The screaming of a vehicle engine at high RPMs and a handful of outgoing 5.56mm rounds sent him rolling off his bed and onto the floor before a massive shockwave blew the glass from his bedroom window. Reese knew what it was immediately. VBIED, just like in Iraq. Who the hell had found them out here? Not now, Reese. Win the fight. A switch flipped in his mind. He was no longer at a safe house in Redacted. He was at war. Wearing only boxers and a t-shirt, with no time to get fully suited up, Reese slid into his running shoes as he processed the situation. He was sure that the vehicle-borne explosion had breached the wall of the compound. If this was a coordinated attack, which he believed it was, whoever had targeted them would be surging in at any moment. He'd seen this tactic before. A second blast hit the back side of the compound near the buildings where the other occupants lived. As he crawled quickly across the room and felt for his plate carrier in the darkness, he could hear the unmistakable sound of suppressed rounds coming from the window of the room down the hall. Freddy's strain was already engaging targets. Reese did a quick rundown of friendly forces. Freddy, 4 redacted security personnel, and his Islamic studies teacher, Majid. He quickly pulled on his armor and helmet, less for protection than for the advantage of the NODs mounted to it. He found his MP7 leaning against the wall and pulled the two-point sling over his head as he activated the IR aiming laser. He wore Peltor tactical ear protection with a boom microphone integrated into his helmet, but without a radio there was no way to communicate with the other friendlies. Knowing that Freddy was overwatch at the window, Reese cracked his door and peered into the hallway. Whoever had planned this was following the now familiar script from Iraq and Afghanistan of using a vehicle to breach the perimeter before flooding the compound with fanatical men armed with small arms and suicide vests. The lack of gunfire from the perimeter indicated that the redacted contractor who had fired at the approaching vehicle before it exploded had been either killed or seriously wounded by the blast. The hallway was dark and quiet in the green glow of his NODs. Only the popping of Freddy's outgoing rounds audible over the ringing in Reese's ears. Reese peered over the balcony railing and saw no sign of movement below. He crept slowly and quietly down the stairs, his lightweight running shoes masking his movement. Close-quarters combat is a tricky game of angles, and Reese used his years of training and experience to his advantage as he made his way toward the front of the structure. As he sliced the pie of the corner that led into the home's grand entryway, incoming full-auto gunfire sprayed across the front of the building, shattering the windows. Those rounds sounded suppressed. What the hell is going on? He took a knee behind an antique bookshelf and could hear rounds impacting the building's thick stone walls. Fortunately, they did not penetrate. Good cover. Reese rose to his feet and spotted muzzle flashes through the window's opening. A dozen-round burst from his submachine gun sent the shooter to the afterlife. He checked to ensure that no one had entered the room behind him and moved closer to the window to get a better angle on the area outside. He could see a ragged black hole in the perimeter wall 40 yards away, the blinding flames of the burning vehicle casting strange shadows of twisted metal across the yard. Two men carrying M4s sprinted through the breach, running laterally across Reese's vantage point. He held his fire, confused by the sight of weapons and gear typically associated with friendlies. When they aimed their fully automatic fire at the upper level where Freddy held the high ground, he snapped out of his paralysis. He led the first man and put a burst into him that sent him tumbling forward onto the ground. The second runner tripped over the falling man, causing Reese to miss him high. He adjusted his aim and stitched the remainder of his magazine into him as he attempted to regain his feet. A headshot into the front of his face dropped him for good. M4s? Why are we being attacked by a unit using M4s? Later, Reese. You know what to do. Words from Reese's father came to him.
If something just doesn't look right, it's probably not.
Reese took a moment to study the men he had put down and was surprised that one was attempting to regain his feet. Too many men to count had been killed by people they thought were dead. Reese took careful aim, depressed the trigger, and sent a round through the PVS-15 night vision attached to a helmet similar to the one worn by Reese and into the left eye socket of his attacker.
Night vision? I need to see one of these guys closer up.
Reese stripped the empty magazine from the weapon and inserted a fresh one from a pouch on the front of his armor before hitting the slide release and sending the bolt home. A firefight erupted behind the main house, from the direction of the security contractor's building. The longer strings of fire were being answered by short bursts from what sounded like a belt-fed weapon, which let Reese know that at least one of the redacted contractors was alive and fighting. As Reese scanned for targets, a window broke behind him and suppressed gunfire erupted into the room. An attacker had made his way to the back of the house and was firing his M4 with its muzzle stuck through the window. Reese dropped prone behind a large sofa, effectively pinned down by the shooter.
Only concealment, not cover. Move, Reese!
The rounds blistered the wall above his head, filling the room with dust and sending tiny red-hot bullet fragments into Reese's exposed legs. He crawled toward the heavy wooden front door, thinking that he could head outside to maneuver behind the shooter. As he reached the door, two more M4-wielding attackers fired at the front of the house from the direction of the breach.
their rounds thudding into the walls and door, leaving Rhys with no means of escape. The fully automatic fire from the rear of the house continued, chewing the room's fine furnishings into splinters. Rhys had a fragmentation grenade in a pouch on his armor, but the window he'd have to throw it through was small, and he couldn't risk the explosive bouncing off the wall back in his direction.
"Freddy, I'm pinned down here!" Rhys yelled, hoping that his partner could hear him over the sounds of battle.
The firing resumed, his attackers unable to get a good angle on their target. Time slowed as muzzle flashes illuminated the smoke, airborne plaster, and concrete dust filling the house, the entire room flashing like a strobe-lit nightclub through the green display of the NODs, a surreal and visceral assault on the senses. Nothing back from Freddy, which meant he was in a fight of his own, or dead. Rhys had to move. He waited for the shooter to change magazines, then rose to his knees to unbolt the front door. As he did, he heard something thud onto the floor to his right and roll across the tile. The grenade spun like a top 5 yards away, its fuse burning rapidly toward the explosive charge and coiled wire concealed beneath the outside casing. Rhys yanked open the door and button-hooked through to escape the blast. His sudden emergence from the door surprised the man who had tossed the frag, stacked outside, preparing to make entry following detonation. Rhys couldn't stop his forward momentum and found himself crashing into the team who had moments before held the upper hand. Speed, surprise, violence of action. Forcing his attacker's rifle up and out of the way as he tumbled into the first man in the stack, the strong smell of sweat filling his nostrils, Rhys drove the suppressed MP7 into his opponent's throat, zipping a burst of 4.6mm rounds through the enemy's neck and into the face of the man behind him. The thunderous detonation of the grenade sent shards of the already shattered window into the side of Rhys's head and shoulder, as his momentum sent him into the last man in the stack. Momentarily confused by the two men in front of him dropping to the ground, and from the dust and debris exploding through the open door and window, he was not ready for the full weight and fury of the man who had suddenly appeared like a vision of death from out of the chaos. With his NODs dusted out from the explosion, Rhys felt more than saw the man in full battle gear before him, his MP7 caught up in the collision of man and gear. Face to face with the enemy, his MP7 knocked to the side, Rhys seamlessly transitioned to the knife on the front of his body armor, crashing the gap and indexing the chest plate on the man before him with his elbow, using it as a reference point to sink the blade into his throat. Quickly, Rhys stepped left to sweep the man's leg and put his startled enemy on the ground. A knife fight is not like it's portrayed in the movies. It's close, it's personal, it's visceral. It's the most primal and devastating thing one man can do to another. And sometimes men die hard. Rhys did not shy from the task. From his dominant mount position, he drove his shoulder down and into the pommel of his blade, driving it deeper into the unprotected neck of his adversary, whose body, mind, and spirit were finding the reserve of strength and energy known only to those on the brink of death. Rhys grabbed his opponent's NODs, twisting them from his head, finding the carotid artery with the edge of his blade and trapping the arm, while moving his blade just below the armpit and driving it into the lungs. Avoiding the body armor designed to protect, Rhys used it as a guide. Sliding perpendicular to find the side control position, Rhys transitioned